The Democratic field in the race for governor is getting awfully crowded. We look at who's in and who may be joining them. Are investigators being punished for doing too good of a job exposing problems at Lincoln Hills? We get the latest. We also have an update on the U.S. Senate race. Money is flowing in. Who's giving and who's getting? All that, plus winners and losers, and your questions, today on JS on Politics. Welcome to JS on Politics. I'm your host, Mary Spicuzza. I'm joined by Patrick Marley in Madison and Daniel Bice here in Milwaukee to talk about the latest in the governor's race. So for a while, I remember how we were talking about no Democrat wants to get in the race, and now it's kind of the opposite, where a lot of Democrats want to get in the race.
Eight candidates now.
Right.
I think of two of them as minor candidates, and then six as sort of minor, major, or major, minor candidates. Because we don't have any major candidate on this side, but we do have eight candidates, six of whom have either been in office or they have money and they're planning to spend. And the most recent one is Matt Flynn, who announced this week that he's running, a former Democratic Party chairman. He's run for office four previous times, lost all four times. He's now 70, retired, and has decided this is how he wants to spend retirement, running around the state campaigning to be governor.
And he's facing some questions and criticism about his role in the priest abuse scandal, representing the Catholic Church.
Right. There are a number of questions. I asked him, you've lost four times before, what's different this time? And he said he's not put off easily on things he wants to pursue. And most of what he had to say fit in line with the other Democrats. He did say he wants to roll back right to work, that he wants to get rid of Act 10, and he criticized the Foxconn deal. But then I also asked him about his representation of the Archdiocese of Milwaukee for 15 years, from the late 80s to 2004. And, you know, he had the job of representing the church against people who said that they were victims of sexual abuse by priests. Mm-hmm. And some people, including SNAP, the group that represents these victims, has said that he was overly aggressive in some of his representation of the church. For instance, in several cases, when someone would file a suit and the suit would be tossed out, usually because it was outside the statute of limitations, he and the church then filed liens or judgments against those people for his legal and Quarles and Brady's legal costs. He says this is just routine, and when the church found out about this, they paid him back, and we haven't yet gone back and checked to see if that's true, but it's something we're going to be doing. And then the other one has to do with a case where he was in a discussion with another attorney representing five of these victims, and he's quoted by the National Catholic Reporter telling this guy that you're going to lose all your cases, so we'll toss you a few crumbs if you just drop the suit, and we'll give you a few crumbs to pay for therapy. He says he didn't use the word crumbs, but he said he probably did discuss therapy because that was common in dealing with negotiations and settlement talks. So a little bit, you know, it's a difficult thing because in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, the situation and people's attitudes towards some of this stuff, I think, it was different than what it is now. And so now he's having to reflect back on and discuss some of these issues. So I think there'll probably be more scrutiny on that in the future with Matt.
It sounds like it. Patrick, are you hearing from, in terms of Dems in Madison at the Capitol, is there a favorite or a few people that you think have broader support among lawmakers there? Or is it too early to tell?
No, I think that's why we have as big a field as we do, is that there is no favorite. I mean, everybody's got some level of support in their little categories of people that they can get help from. But nobody's come into this race that scared others out. And if anything, the field could get bigger. It looks like Kelda Royce, a former state representative, is very seriously looking at this. Malin Mitchell, who ran for lieutenant governor during the recall. So, I mean, we're just going to see more and more people, and that just changes the total dynamic of the primary, because you're talking about somebody being able to get the nomination with, you know, perhaps 25% of the vote, presuming that everybody stays in.
Remember when California had 150 candidates run? But clearly eight is not enough. We are going to end up with 9, 10, how many ever people.
And nobody has cleared the field, obviously.
Right. And actually, Flynn said that when explaining why he's getting into the race. He said he looked at the field of candidates and thought, I can do better than them. And I'm sure other people will look even after he's in the race and say, I can do better than them. So, yeah, you know, there will be some winnowing going on, but all the while, the governor will be able to sit back and just watch the Democrats take shots at each other.
And raise money.
So. Right. Yeah, he'll be doing that.
Okay.
There's a downside for the governor, too, though, in that now instead of having, like, one candidate that reporters are going to get the opposition view, there's eight of them. You know, he's going to be having to deal, I mean, he may view them as mosquitoes at times, but there's going to be all these different voices criticizing his agenda and what he's done in the state.
Kind of spread out their opposition research team a bit if you're researching a dozen people, probably. So
probably
I think
their
opposition file is pretty complete on Governor Walker. I mean, all
oh,
the
no,
voters.
I mean the opposition field on Dem candidates on a, when there are that many.
Yes, that is true.
It's actually going to keep us busy for the next year or so, digging into the backgrounds and the past of these individuals.
Of all 12 or however many get in the race.
Right.
Thanks, guys. So we're actually going to turn now to Lincoln Hills. And Patrick, I wanted to ask you about, obviously, this has been an ongoing concern about problems at Lincoln Hills and the investigations there. What are we hearing now about? It sounds like investigators are saying maybe they did too good of a job.
Yeah, there were a couple of developments this week. One was that we turned up from some open records about what some of the internal investigators thought about the way their unit was handled. So there was this internal affairs group called the Office of Special Operations. They started the internal investigation of Lincoln Hills, and that their internal investigation now complete. It was done with some others from the department, but they were entirely shut down in June of this year, and their work spread out to other parts of the department. And I found a record where they were talked about how their workload was diminishing. They weren't doing employee investigations. They said they thought that was because they had, quote, made the department look bad and done too thorough a job at Lincoln Hills.
So basically, maybe don't investigate so hard next time, they felt like was the message there.
That was their perception. And the administration says that's not true, that they think they can do these investigations in a more efficient manner, and that the conduct of the investigation in Lincoln Hills had nothing to do with ending this internal affairs organization.
Even working on some... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say the other development this week is, you know, there is a lawsuit over conditions at Lincoln Hills. Lincoln Hills is under a separate criminal investigation, but we've also got this lawsuit brought by the ACLU alleging that there are civil rights violations there. A judge ordered pretty sweeping changes there that the state has been trying to comply with. They filed a report this week with the court saying that they had had some challenges doing that because of what they called, quote, significant unrest at the facility.
And it seems like for all the calls to close Lincoln Hills, there hasn't really been broad agreement on what alternative people should pursue. I know Milwaukee had talked about more regional facilities and not having a huge facility up north so far away from many of the Milwaukee inmates here.
Yeah, we've never really seen that idea gain much traction in the legislature. They don't seem interested in that, going with that strategy that Milwaukee has proposed or that advocates are calling for. You know, one of the major reasons is because of cost. Building a new facility in Milwaukee or even retrofitting an existing one would be very expensive. If you go to a regional model, instead of having one facility for the most serious juvenile offenders, you know, it's obviously going to be more expensive if you have to build or refurbish ones all over the state.
Thank you. I spoke earlier with Bill Glauber, a reporter here who's been covering the U.S. Senate race. We got some new fundraising numbers and some new issues to talk about. So here's what Bill had to say. I'm joined now by Bill Glauber to talk about the latest in the U.S. Senate race. So, Bill, the race is still more than a year away, but apparently
you have to remind me of that. Yeah.
So we got some new fundraising numbers this week. What are we seeing?
They're big numbers. Tammy Baldwin raised $2.4 million in the third quarter of the year. That's an extraordinary haul. Anybody who thinks she doesn't want this race, doesn't want to win, you got to look at those numbers. They're very impressive. On the other side, the other two candidates, Leah Vukmir and Kevin Nicholson, they just got into the race during the third quarter. Their number's far lower. Nicholson said he raised a little bit more than $400,000. Vukmir, $250,000. They have a primary they have to fight through. It's a different kind of funding mechanism for the Republican side. They both have super PACs supporting them.
So it remains to be seen how important the actual fundraising numbers are in that race as opposed to the super PAC dollars, unlimited cash coming into the race.
Which could presumably be used to attack Tammy Baldwin.
But it could also be used earlier to attack each other to support their candidacies. It's something that that Jeb Bush attempted in the most recent presidential campaign, obviously failed, but it looks like that may be the model going forward for the Republicans in this race. But Baldwin, by any measure, impressive numbers, and they're a sign that Democrats take this race very seriously. They simply have to win this race to keep that seat as well as to set the stage for the 2020 presidential campaign.
And what's the latest issue in the race?
Well, money, but not campaign money, your money, taxes and spending. You know, Republicans are coming out big this week for the Trump tax outline. That's all it is. It's just an outline at this point. It's not really solid proposals with charts. So the Republicans are stepping up, putting pressure on Baldwin, saying that she's a tax and spend liberal. Baldwin counters that the Republican tax plan is a giveaway. She has a plan outlined with Cory Booker to try to help lower middle class workers, you know, try to get that step on the American dream. I don't know how many people are paying attention to all of this, but that's sort of the backstory about what's going on this week.
They were actually just in Milwaukee. I saw them last Friday presenting their tax plan, talking about, you know, child tax credits, and definitely a different approach than the Trump administration.
Absolutely a different approach. And then Cory Booker did go to a fundraiser for Baldwin. So they combined the two. And Elizabeth Warren is due in this sometime in October to also do a fundraiser for Tammy Baldwin. So the Democrats are bringing out their big guns, so to speak, to help Baldwin raise money and fight off the challenge.
So you should have a busy 13 months here heading into the next election.
It's going to be a busy 13 months. And it kicks off with Hillary Clinton's appearance November 9th, selling her book, coming to Wisconsin a year too late. And we'll probably hear some of what was going through her mind with Wisconsin. But, you know, what's past, the past, the prologue is the present and the future. So it's going to be some interesting political times here in Wisconsin over the next year.
Okay. Thanks for your time. I'm back with Daniel Bice and Patrick Marley for Winners and Losers.
Our favorite part of the show.
Our favorite part of the show. And you usually come up with all losers, but you actually have a winner this week.
I do. So. Well, actually,
breaking Bill, tradition.
Bill was just bringing it, and you usually have multiple losers.
Exactly. You can't choose. So who's your winner?
Bill just discussed Tammy Baldwin raising $2.4 million in the last quarter, which is impressive. The downside is the two Republicans are in have billionaires backing them and are likely to use set up third-party groups. Well, one has already done so to spend money on their behalf. So she's got to raise as much money as possible to be able to fend off the criticism she'll be getting from these outside groups. And obviously $2.4 million doesn't match that, but she needs to raise as much money as possible. And she will probably have third-party groups get in on her side too, but the problem there is you can't control the message. So it's more money than I expected her to raise in the quarter, because she's been okay as a fundraiser in the past, but this is making it clear that this is a serious thing.
Mm-hmm. And that she's, 2.4 is not a bad start.
So. Yeah, for a quarter, particularly this far out from the election. Mm-hmm. But, you know, these elections start earlier and earlier. You know, some of the most significant stories in the Feingold-Johnson race happened in the summer, before the summer, in the race. And you know, people are going to go on air earlier and earlier as well. So so she has to raise this money now.
And what about your losers?
You know, the big story this past week has been about Harvey Weinstein and his the problems, the sexual harassment, sexual assaults and everything. It started Thursday last week, and now we have criminal investigations against him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's resigned or been fired. So a lot of activity, but in terms of politics, he's been a big, big Democratic supporter, spent lots of money. And even in his first statement, he made this bizarre comment that he's going to focus his efforts now on attacking the NRA.
Right.
And it took the Democrats Democrats a while to adjust to this. Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, who've gotten significant funding from him, and Weinstein's done events for them. Mm-hmm. It took them 5 days to respond, and a lot of people wondered about that. And I think there was actually some, people were taking a long time to process this, because the stuff Weinstein did is much worse, I think, than what Donald Trump is doing. We tend to focus on Donald Trump, what horrible things he said on the Billy Bush interview. Mm-hmm. But these are actual actions, things he was doing. And it wasn't once, twice. I mean, we're now talking about dozens of incidents. Those are the ones we know about. This was mm-hmm. someone who abused his power to get what he wanted to do. And it was I just think it was a sense where it took a long time for these politicians to process the fact that he was such a hypocrite in what he was doing, you know, giving money to women's groups while at the same time seducing 20-year-olds in his hotel. So
the New York Times story came out, but then there was this very in-depth New Yorker story, which actually included Asia Argento and others talking about him essentially raping them. And so it kind of went even further than the New York Times story in terms of number of victims who
right.
were being
named. And I've said, you know, the initial New York Times story was pretty, it was, there weren't a lot of details there. There were anecdotes from 20 years ago, some discussion about various stuff. But as soon as that story ran, it opened the floodgates. And I think it opened the floodgates from mainly actresses, not so much from actors affected by him and politicians, just a few politicians at the beginning. Some have now agreed to give some of the money away. But, he gave to everything, including the Clinton Foundation, as well as her campaign. And Weinstein's been given to Democrats since the 90s.
It was interesting, both with the Weinstein victims and the women who said they were assaulted by Trump, because beyond the tapes, there was also the women who said he forced himself upon them or groped them. But often, I think, when men are in positions of power, there is a lot of fear from victims that they will be crushed. And so you do hear these 10, 20-year delays of women coming forward and kind of strengthen numbers, because I think, as Asia Argento talked about, there was a fear that Weinstein had crushed others and would crush her.
There was a lot of people have come to this conclusion that, you know, sexual harassment is a thing associated with Donald Trump, but it's clearly something that's not associated with either political party.
Right.
And it took even the late night comedians to figure out it took them days and days to figure out how to respond to this. Some people tried to say, well, here's Trump and here's Weinstein. But his stuff is, I think, from what we know so far, and now there are criminal investigations in the States as well as in London. We're talking about very serious stuff here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He could be facing charges as well as firing. Okay, Patrick, who are your winners this week?
Well, kind of building on what you two were just talking about, my winners are the victims of sexual assault and sexual harassment, because their voices are being heard. They're coming forward, not just necessarily the Weinstein victims, but I think that this gives people generally more of a willingness to come forward and to have more confidence that when something bad happens to them, that they will be believed. Obviously, one of the reasons that people stay quiet when powerful people are involved is that they think that the public's not going to believe them.
And, you know, I think it's true that more people are able to speak out now because they saw that he was going to be fired or whatever, even though he doesn't still seem to understand what he's done and the seriousness of what he's done. So, there's still the power dynamic. If he weren't resigning or being fired, would all of these people be stepping forward? I think probably some of them would, but maybe others, because, you know, you just look through the list of films that he's produced, and, you know, his movies have had more than 300 Oscar nominations. But when it was clear there was a tipping point and it was moving against him, it's a lot easier at that point to say, that something happened in my particular case.
Mm-hmm. Patrick, who is your loser then?
Okay, so moving to a totally different issue, my loser of the week is the Milwaukee Metropolitan Association of Commerce and other businesses in the Milwaukee area, because the I-94 East-West project is officially dead. It was put in the Federal Register this week that the federal approval for that project is taken away. That means likely many years before that stretch between the Zoo Interchange and the Marquette Interchange is reconstructed. It could be that in coming years we will likely have to do some kind of work there, but it would be temporary work until that project can be fully reconstructed. It won't have additional capacity. It's going to be sort of a choke point between those two major interchanges. That was a huge priority for the business community to get that project, you know, lined up and get work started on it.
And one other issue that doesn't fit quite into the winners and losers is this very sad story that's going on with, again, something that affects both political parties are these heroin incidents involving Representative Nygren's daughter, who has been out there, and we've even done a profile of her at the Journal Sentinel, and she's now facing possible criminal charges for her role in the death of someone in a heroin overdose. And then also the
sounds like that woman was 6 months pregnant, so actually the fetus didn't survive either.
Right, and then a situation involving Jason Seidner, the former executive, and he was the executive director until just recently of the Democratic Party, and another incident that occurred at his house. And he's not been charged, but that's something that police are looking at. It's just a, you know, and even Governor Walker tweeted about this yesterday that, you know, this shows that the near epidemic on this situation is affecting people, you know, in all walks of life.
And there was just another wave of deaths in
how many was it? It was like 13 people.
I think it was about 11 in 4 days.
Yeah,
I could be
right
on the numbers. But yeah, it's very sad, and it's clearly affecting a lot of families of all political parties. So, okay, well, we're actually going to move on to some viewer questions, and we've got a few. I don't think we'll be able to get through all of them, but we're going to try to take at least a few of these. The first one comes from Christopher, who asks, I saw President Trump on TV last night, and he was talking about his tax plan. Has anyone at the papers seen his plan? Can you please explain specifically how it would help me, a family of four earning $45,000 a year? Let's see. Patrick, you want to try to take that one?
Yeah, I'm not going to pretend to know the ins and outs of that federal tax policy, but I would say that, you know, the early criticism of it is that it would help the wealthy and businesses more than people of moderate incomes.
A family of four earning $45,000.
Right.
I think the trick on the tax reform, which Republicans are going to view as absolutely essential that they get done, given that they couldn't achieve the repeal of Obamacare, is that, you know, this senators, the Republicans all want to make tax reform, but they've only got 52 members, and they all have very different ideas about how to do it and the best way to do it and how much you can allow the deficit to rise when you do it. They can't lose more than two votes. That is the same dynamic and challenge that they had in the Affordable Care Act debate.
Yeah, and getting into fights with Senator Corker is probably not a good way to keep that coalition together.
It would probably be helpful to, I don't feel like this has been a very detail-heavy plan with, you know, it doesn't sound, I think there are a lot of questions that remain about Trump's tax plan. The next one comes from Jessica, who asks, why did it take so long for Democrats to condemn the information published in the New York Times about Harvey Weinstein? Goes on to talk about Hillary Clinton taking 5 days to say something. You touched on this already. Obviously, you know, one, it's not like one side of the aisle is pure when it comes to sexual harassment and mistreatment of women.
But, you know, if it had been Trump and we found out that five women stepped forward and had settled with him and that there was an incident back in 97 involving somebody, Democrats would have been all over that.
And sure.
Not in hours or days, but within minutes.
Right.
And I think, you know, I think there is a little bit of hypocrisy in there that the belief is that that's something the other side does, not us.
They have the war on women, we support women kind of thing.
Yeah, and there were a few people who stepped forward, and, you know, and now that's been this long and he's been fired, the situation's changed. But, you know, 1 day, 2 day, 3 days, and finally fifth day, they decided to step forward and talk about it. I agree with the person raising the question. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This one comes from Claire. Your article did not say how much money came from out-of-state donations. Patrick, have we seen that kind of detail yet?
Is that Senator Baldwin?
I assume they're talking about the new Senate numbers that we just talked about with Bill Glauber. It was my understanding that these were kind of more some general numbers that they had released without giving the details yet.
So usually what happens before the actual public filing of these kinds of documents, campaigns will be proud of their numbers and put and release summaries to the press or others that just say, we raised $2 million. Without getting into this sort of line by line, who gave what. So I just don't think we've been able to see that analysis
now. In the past, she has received a lot of out-of-state money, so it wouldn't be surprising if she did. But, you know, Senator Feingold received a significant out-of-state money. This is a race that transcends Wisconsin. It's important to all of us, mm-hmm. but the impacts can be felt nationally. So it's not going to be a surprise if all the candidates.
And I think the same in the House Speaker's race. Paul Ryan obviously gets a lot of money from out of state.
That's going to be true.
And you know, Randy Bryce will too.
On the Republican side, with Nicholson, Breitbart was already promoting his candidacy online earlier this week. So I wouldn't be surprised if that brings some attention and a few dollars his way as a result of that.
Right. All right. Well, thank you, Patrick. Thank you, Mr. Bice. We'll be back next week for JS on Politics.